dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. Our duty expert on matters involving intelligence is Fred Flights, a career intelligence professional with the Central Intelligence Agency at the Department of State, where he worked as chief of staff for Ambassador John Bolton, and on the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence of the House of Representatives, where he worked with its chairman, our friend Pete Hoekstra. Fred, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Frank.
Let's talk about a story that has come out of the Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald machine in the past day or two, involving some putative new affront to civil liberties by the FBI and National Security Agency. What's the truth?
This is an incredible story, Frank. This week, a document leaked by Edward Snowden and put to the media by Glenn Greenwald and one of his associates, they try to use this document to say that the U.S. government, the FBI and the NSA, are targeting American Muslims merely because of their ethnicity and their religion for surveillance. And they said several hundred Americans are being monitored under this system, which they said is a violation of their Fourth Amendment rights. But they said American Muslims are being particularly targeted, and they named seven of them. And they said five of these clearly are people who have done absolutely nothing wrong, have not been accused of a crime, and there's no reason to monitor them. Two was Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan. They were both with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They were killed in a 2011 drone strike. The other five were Nihat Awad, the executive director of the Council on Islamic Relations, Nushan Amirati, a Rutgers professor who's president of the American Iranian Council, Asim Kafur, a defense lawyer who's handled terrorism-related cases, Fazil Gil, who worked for the Homeland Security Council, and Saga Saeed, the chairman of the American Muslim Council. The last five all have ties to organizations with links to Hamas, Hezbollah, and al-Qaeda. And one has ties to an organization linked to Iran. This is Hashan Amirati, who actually ran for the president of Iran. So this claim by Greenwald, and the New York Times ran a story on this week, that these people were identified for surveillance merely because of their ethnicity and their religion simply doesn't pass the smell test when you look at their suspicious affiliations.
Let's talk about two of them in particular, because they are very problematic characters as far as I'm concerned. One is Fazil Gil, and this is a fellow who was described by Greenwald primarily as having, as you say, worked in the Bush administration, but having run for political office as a candidate for the House of Delegates in Virginia, with the strong support, I might add, of Grover Norquist, a man who has been documented by me and others for his extensive efforts on behalf of Islamists, notably in trying to bring them into Republican circles. Talk a little bit about Fazil Gil and particularly his relationship with a fellow by the name of Abdurrahman Alamoudi, Fred Flights.
Well, Fazil Gil's communications were apparently monitored, and I might add, with court permission. This wasn't NSA acting without permission. Fazil Gil was a consultant for the American Muslim Council, a group founded by Abdurrahman Alamoudi. And this guy is currently in prison for participating in a Libyan plot to assassinate Saudi Prince Abdullah and for illegal financial transactions with the Libyan government. When they went over Alamoudi, these papers, Gil was mentioned numerous times, and he was investigated by the Department of Homeland Security, where he was working at the time, for his associations with this guy. It came out later that when he filed papers for his security clearance, he did not mention he had ties to Alamoudi. He did mention his ties to Grover Norquist, Frank, I've been in the intelligence business. When you don't mention something like this, this can be a felony. But there were no felony charges filed.
Well, there was an investigation conducted of his failure to fully disclose ties to a terrorist. He, as I understand it, was suspended temporarily. Senator John Kyle expressed considerable concern about this individual's role in the Homeland Security Department and then at the White House. But it seems as though the White House, under the influence, I believe, of Karl Rove, very close to Grover Norquist, squashed that investigation, or at least did not allow it to amount to anything. This is the sort of thing that we've documented in a course, as you know, Fred Flights, at MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com. You can find out a lot of information about this in part 6 of the course. This is the sort of thing that I believe constitutes a deep penetration and influence operation against the right. Very troubling stuff. Niyad Awad is another character. Remind us, Fred Flights, of the nature of the Council on American-Islamic Relations and the genesis of this group.
Well, this is an organization which the New York Times describes as a Muslim civil rights organization. But the Council on American Islamic Relations was named by the U.S. government as a co-conspirator in the prosecution of the Holy Land Foundation, a Muslim charity later convicted of providing material support for terrorism by funneling money to Hamas. This is a branch of Hamas in the United States.
And when you say that, Fred, it's important to say that this is not just your opinion. This is something that was documented in the Holy Land Foundation trial by the FBI, by the government, because they were able to introduce into evidence wiretaps of the organizational meeting of the Council on American Islamic Relations in which Niyad Awad participated. And those wiretaps made absolutely clear this was a front for Hamas. This was to help raise funds for it and to basically wage political warfare on behalf of that Muslim Brotherhood franchise.
That's exactly right. And this organization has rejected those claims. And they repeatedly attack anyone who raises them as attacking them because they're Muslims. And that's how this story by Greenwald and from the Snowden leaks is also being portrayed. This is just another example of persecution of innocent American Muslims.
And the trouble is, as is generally the case with these guys, when Keith Ellison, for example, member of Congress, takes to the floor to denounce any efforts to engage in the sort of surveillance that is not only fully warranted but absolutely necessary that we see, I'm afraid, particularly under this administration, but thanks to Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, as we documented in our course, and also in a new monograph on the subject entitled Agent of Influence, Grover Norquist and the Assault, Islamist Assault on the Right. This is the sort of thing that has really, I think, subverted the United States government in a critical way in the midst of a war with Islamists and jihadists bent on our destruction. Fred, let me switch gears very quickly. Next Tuesday, you're going to participate in an event at the National Press Club. I'm very grateful for you doing so, to look at another subject that may also have some ominous overtones for our, well, privacy, perhaps, certainly for our information security, at the hands of a new initial public offering by an outfit called Alibaba, a Chinese enterprise associated in numerous ways, of course, with the Chinese government. This is a subject that we'll be addressing at greater length, of course, in the course of that program. And I just wanted to say thank you. Watch this space. We'll be talking more about it in the run-up to it. We look forward very much to your comments and those of Kevin Freeman, one of our other senior fellows who specializes in economic warfare by the Chinese and other participants as well. Fred, we have to let it go at that for the moment. Thank you very much for your work as a senior fellow for the Center for Security Policy and also your terrific contributions to the Langley Intelligence Group Network's work. You can find out more about that at lignet.com. Fred, join us again next week. Until then, all the best. Josh Moravchik is up next. He'll be talking about his new book, Making David into the Goliath: How the World Turned Against Israel, right after this.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
On August 2nd, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors.
Dedicated to supporting the troops and their families.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families, retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
Hello, I'm Gary Sinise. It's been 20 years since Forrest Gump, and the story of Lieutenant Dan's triumphant return to normalcy is still a part of my life. I'm honored to share it with the real-life Lieutenant Dan's living among us, the more than 1,700 battle-injured amputees that have returned home since 9/11. As citizens, it's our duty to ensure these heroes get the care they need. Join the Gary Sinise Foundation and help support America's wounded heroes. Visit GarySiniseFoundation.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to have with us for two segments an old friend and colleague, and I've admired for many years, Joshua Moravchik. He is today a Foreign Policy Institute Fellow at my alma mater, Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He is a former member of, among other things, the U.S. State Department Advisory Committee on Democracy Promotion. He has been on the business of democracy promotion for many years. And he is most recently the author, I believe it is his 11th book, of Making David into Goliath, How the World Turned Against Israel. Josh Moravcek, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Frank Gaffney, thanks for having me on. It's nice to be reunited with you after
too long a time. Close but no cigar, as they say. We're working in Washington almost side by side, but rarely see each other. But I'm delighted to have a chance to chat with you. And congratulations on this new book. I've long thought, Josh, that one of the greatest influence operations of all time, going back perhaps to the Trojan horse, where a false bill of goods was perpetrated on people with devastating effects, has been this transformation, as you say, of Israel from the David against a sea of Goliaths in the Middle East into the Goliath against these poor Palestinians. Talk a little bit about how this has been accomplished, Josh.
I think it's the product of two kinds of forces that have been at work over the last 40 years that that Israel's enemies have employed or deployed. On the one hand, material forces, and on the other hand, intellectual forces. The material forces start with the fact that there's a sheer weight of numbers on the Arab-Muslim side. For every Jew in the world, there are 100 Muslims. There's one small state of Israel. There are 22 member states of the Arab League. There are 57 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
And a lot of petrodollars besides. We're talking with Josh Moravcek, the author of Making David into Goliath, How the World Turned Against Israel. And you were describing, Josh, that there's a material component to this. A lot of this has to do with not just sheer numbers, but also the wealth of these enemies of Israel.
Well, there's the wealth. There is the threat of oil manipulation. And there was a long era of terrorism that in Europe and in Arab countries that served to silence the moderate Arabs and to bring Europe and Japan to their knees.
I haven't noticed that the era has ended. Is it maybe gone into somewhat of an abatement for the moment in certain places? But
no, but they've stayed on their knees. But compared to the 1970s, when the Palestinians first put themselves on the map by a string of hijackings, bombings, what have you, there's much less of that in Europe these days. So all of these things, the money, the oil, the terrorism, the sheer weight of numbers taking over that enabled the Arabs to take over the UN, those are what I call the material pressures. On the other side is an intellectual development that I'm not sure that that Israel's enemies created it, but they've exploited it brilliantly. And that is, for about a century, from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century, the core idea or so-called paradigm of leftist, liberal, progressive thought was class struggle, the poor against the rich, the workers against the capitalists.
We call it income inequality here today, I think, don't we?
Well, this is an echo of it. But really, I think that paradigm lost its force, its steam, somewhere in the latter part of the 20th century, and a more exciting, newer paradigm of struggle seized the imaginations of leftist progressives, and that was ethnic, national, racial struggle, post-colonial struggle, the rest against the West, the people of color against the white man. And that kind of identity politics, I think, is still with us today. It's become, in my opinion, the dominant thought at the core of leftist progressive thought. And if you look at the world through that lens, Israel are the Western white guys, the Arabs, the Palestinians are the anti-colonial people of color, and by definition, the white guys are always wrong, and the people of color are always right, and it doesn't matter what either side actually does to each other.
Yeah. Josh Muravchik of the Foreign Policy Institute at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies is our guest. And Josh, you were, of course, of the left yourself for a time. You have come a long way, baby, but you certainly know some of these ideological agendas very well. And to the extent that you mentioned a moment ago, the UN has been a vehicle for promoting this agenda. One of the entities that has been particularly aggressive in using the UN for such purposes of demonization of Israel and for that matter, you know, taking down the West more generally is something called the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC. How important in this ideological struggle, as well as in the material one, has the use of the UN been to sort of legitimating the demonization of Israel?
Well, I think it's been extremely important. You know, we Americans have learned through bitter lessons that the UN is something of a farce, and I think a lot of Americans don't take it very seriously. But if you travel around the world, and particularly around the third world, but even in Europe, people still look at the UN with absolute reverence, like it's the most the central source of knowledge and judgment in the world. And the Arabs just were able, over a period of years, to take control of the UN, because the UN is dominated everywhere except in the Security Council, where the U.S. has a veto, but in every other U.N. body, it's majority rule, and that means rule by the non-aligned movement. And actually, as absurd as it may sound, if you look at the General Assembly, as much as one quarter of all of the votes taken in the General Assembly every year are devoted solely to attacking Israel. That is, the General Assembly can and does discuss every conceivable human problem in the world and any part of the world it wants to discuss, but it ends up spending 25% of its time just on attacking Israel. And then there's one other feature to that, which is there are also three special bodies created within the UN, funded to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, taxpayer money, that are devoted exclusively to attacking Israel and promoting the Palestinian cause. There's not a single body for any other country or issue.
Yeah, it says volumes about the nature of the UN and its real function these days, especially when, a pass is being given. Not only a pass, but you're seeing very considerable legitimation of nations like Iran, for example. Despite its terrorist and genocidal tendencies.
That's right. Iran was elected to chair a committee on women's rights in the U.S.
Right. Of all things. And the human rights and arms control and all manner of other things they have their hands in. As we'll be talking about with Bill Roggio later in the program, the Iranians have figured out how to penetrate these sorts of things at an institutional level. We're going to have to pause here for just a moment. When we come back, we'll be visiting at greater length with Josh Muravchik about not just what has been done to isolate and demonize Israel, including by the Obama administration, but what it is translating into on the ground in the Middle East at the moment. That and more with Josh Muravchik right after this.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If you lived in Israel at the moment, chances are you would be spending at least part of your day in a bomb shelter, or listening to sirens warning you to take cover, or watching the Iron Dome system try to intercept incoming rockets trying to kill you or your countrymen. The Israeli government is at last acting to prevent such threats from emanating from Gaza, territory that Israel once controlled, but that is now a hotbed for jihadist terror sponsored by Hamas. Hamas is the designated terrorist organization that Team Obama recently, insanely, helped assume shared responsibility for part of Israel's historic homeland, Judea and Samaria. U.S. law prohibits American taxpayer funding of such a unity government. U.S. security, not just that of Israel, calls for putting it out of business. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. We're visiting with Joshua Muravchik, a scholar, a national security and foreign policy-minded practitioner of many years and an author of a considerable body of work, including not only the book we've just been discussing, Making David into Goliath, but also Liberal Oasis, The Truth About Israel. There's a terrific review of both books at mosaicmagazine.com. And one of the things, Josh, that I would just invite you to talk a little bit about, because this whole idea of taking Israel from a country that is beyond question, objectively seen as a David facing an array of Goliaths, and transforming it, mutating its public image into something exactly opposite, the oppressive Goliath to the poor Palestinians, David, is something that was substantially engineered, it seems, by Edward Said, Professor Said of Columbia University. Tell us a little bit about him and what your research has shown about his influence.
Well, Edward Said became and remains one of the most influential intellectuals of the past 40 years. His books are still assigned in courses by one Google count, nearly 1,000 different courses in American universities. There's some courses devoted entirely to the thought of Edward Said. So he was an immensely influential intellectual, and and he wrote this dense, hard-to-read book called Orientalism. And so an average person might not even know what that's talking about, but this presumably was the Western scholars who studied Eastern people, and by Eastern he meant primarily Middle Eastern, the Arabs and other Muslims, and he used them as an example to try to prove his core idea. And his core idea was that all white people are racists. Now, you might notice that this is itself a self-contradictory and racist accusation. But that was the core idea, and it came at this moment in the latter part of the 20th century when Americans were rocked, and perhaps, you know, justifiably so, with guilt for facing up to the history of racial discrimination in our own country. And Europeans were wallowing in guilt about having been formerly colonial powers. It's curious that all of this guilt came to the fore after there were no more colonies and after racial discrimination had been defeated in the United States, but somehow that's the way the cultural trends work. And so in that context, when Said came along with this completely fallacious and dishonest scholarship. His examples were false and they were rigged, but nonetheless, it sounded scholarly and its basic idea was that all white people are racists. He became the very epitome of this this guilt complex and this new idea that the most important redemptive process going on in the world was the struggle of the people of color against the horrible racist white people.
Yeah. A corollary to this, of course, was also Said's view that nobody but those from the Middle East, and that is to say only Arabs really, could understand these matters of Orientalism, and therefore no one else has any standing to provide a dissenting view, which you have done over the years with great effect, I must say, Josh Muravchik of the Johns Hopkins University Foreign Policy Institute. Talk, if you would, Josh, a little bit about how the demonization and the delegitimation of Israel, including by the Obama administration, has contributed, if you think it has, to the current challenge that Israel is facing at the moment. Most especially from Hamas, but actually from a whole host of adversaries and deadly enemies in its neighborhood.
I do think it has contributed to the perils that Israel faces, Frank, and I think there are two sides to that. Every time we've had an episode over the past decade, whether you talk about the Intifada that started in 2000 and went on, or the Lebanon war between Israel and Hezbollah in 2006, or the Israeli invasion of Gaza in 2008, or the flotilla incident in 2010, and now, once again, what's going on right now in that area. It follows the same pattern. Some Arab group attacks Israel, kills Israelis, or tries to kill them in the case of the flotilla. Israel fights back in self-defense, and then there is a huge global chorus led by the likes of Jimmy Carter and Bishop Tutu and the UN and all the main newspapers in Europe and what have you that blame Israel and accuse Israel of terrible things for defending itself. The effect of that is that it does take a price on Israel, and so when they are attacked and killed, Israeli leaders are increasingly reluctant to fire back to stop the attacks, as Netanyahu was reluctant this time, visibly reluctant. He kept making threats but not acting on them. And on the other hand, I think that the Hamas and others of their ilk are perfectly smart enough to see what's going on, and they feel emboldened to start these battles, to target Israelis, even knowing that Israel has a lot of power at its disposal to hit back at them, because they can see that Israel has very little support in the world and that it's hard for Israel to act.
Yeah. This can only embolden Israel's enemies, I think, unmistakably. Josh Moravchik, just to stitch together what we were talking about a moment ago, to what extent do you think the influence of a fellow like Rashid Khalidi, who was a longtime colleague of President Obama back at Chicago and then is now the Edward Said Chair at Columbia, and a notorious shill for the Palestinians, notably Yasser Arafat in his day, has helped shape the attitude of the president and his team, manifesting itself not only in overt hostility to Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister, the elected prime minister of Israel, but contributing to this sense that Israel is at best morally equivalent to its enemies, and at worst, well, the Goliath who must be laid low in favor of the Davids of Palestine.
Well, Frank, I can't tell you who shaped President Obama's thinking. I don't have inside information that would enable me to know that. But what is clear is that President Obama is the coldest of any U.S. president toward Israel in more than half a century. And he, in his own way, he was quite plain about it. In his first year in office, Obama said in a meeting, "I need to put distance between the United States and Israel." That allegedly was for the purpose of enhancing his credibility in the Muslim world. And hilariously, in a sense, we have polls that clearly show that Obama is even more unpopular in the Muslim world than George W. Bush was. So it didn't work in that sense, but he certainly has put distance between the United States and Israel.
And it's a distance that is, I'm afraid, contributing perhaps to mortal peril for the people of the Jewish state, and very much to the detriment of our interests as well. Josh, there's so much more to talk about. I hope you might come back and have a even longer visit with us on these issues, as your insights into how we got to this pass and its implications, not just for Israel, as you call it, the David, but for all of us, is tremendously appreciated and valued, and I hope we can do that soon. Again, Josh Moravchik of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies Foreign Policy Institute, the author, most recently, of Making David into Goliath, How the World Turned Against Israel. Josh, thank you. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Bill Roscio about the Long War and more right after this.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com. Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At americasmightywarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At americasmightywarriors.org.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Roggio, a man we have the pleasure of speaking with each week. It's not always pleasurable what we talk about because he is chronicling, as well as anybody, what is happening in what he calls the long war. And unfortunately, much of the news in that space is not good. Bill Roggio is the managing editor of the Long War Journal, a terrific online resource, a project of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he is a senior fellow. And he joins us each week about now to talk about all these things. Bill, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Always a pleasure.
I'd like to sort of get an update from you, Bill, as to what is going on with what is now being called the Islamic State, or the Caliphate, now spanning both Syria and Iraq. What is the current, well, sort of order of battle of this outfit, and is it still growing in terms of its control of territory?
1 month ago, the Islamic State launched its offensive in Iraq, and took over Mosul and much of Saladin and the Diyala province. It was already in control of a lot of Anbar province in the west. Since over the last couple of weeks, the battle lines seem to have been drawn. We're seeing it, that rapid advance has been halted. The Iraqi military and militias have reorganized, and they're able to defend what they've currently held. There's a lot of fighting between the town of Samarra and south to Baghdad. The military launched an offensive in an attempt to retake Tikrit, but that fell apart. So they don't have the ability right now to retake areas under Islamic State control. And then the Islamic State is probing, taking over small villages and towns here and there. It's not a rapid advance any longer. The situation has sort of devolved into what we see in Syria now, where it's sort of a stalemate, where one side may make a gain, a small gain here or there, but the lines of control are pretty much established. But I would say that the Islamic State has the upper hand still. The Iraqi military, from all accounts, is still disorganized, and they're relying heavily on Shia militias, and those are not very well organized. They're certainly not capable of going on the offensive.
Speaking of Syria, Bill, there has seemed to be a shifting, alliances towards the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham, as you wish, that suggests the previous premier sort of status of al-Qaeda-related groups may be shifting. How do you see that at the moment?
I think by it taking over large swaths of territory in Iraq, it has enabled it. It's increased its prestige, and some groups are defecting. There was a group called the Dawood Brigade the other day that defected. It had 10 tanks on 1,000 fighters and 100 trucks. They rolled into Raqqa, which is the capital of the Islamic State inside Syria. And so you're seeing a bit of this. The al-Qaeda is sort of on the defensive right now because they haven't responded to the Islamic State's advance or its declaration of the caliphate. So, it certainly remains to be seen what al-Qaeda is going to do. The top cleric who is very influential and who has Zawahiri's ear, he called on al-Qaeda to respond to this, that they have to say something about the declaration of the Islamic State. So I think there's a lot of unease within al-Qaeda and its branches. That being said, you're basically, they're all jihadists, right? So if there is a decline of al-Qaeda in Syria or in Iraq, it doesn't mean al-Qaeda is defeated or jihadism is defeated. No, you've traded one brand for another. The Islamic State is still a global terrorist organization that says that it is seeking to establish a global caliphate.
One of the abiding questions, the president has now said he wants to spend, as I recall, $500 million more training the elusive moderates in Syria. Are there any more identifiable moderates today in this changing dynamic than there were the last time we talked about this? Is this any better an idea than, as I recall, you thought rather poorly of it the last time we talked?
As I said before, I'm sure there's individual groups here or there, but the problem is that supporting them really has no real impact on the battlefield at this point. The radicals, they control the agenda on the battlefield, and any money you provide or any weapons you provide is very likely to fall into the hands of the Islamist terrorist groups. Look, even groups that we've identified, we claim the Syrian Military Council, the head of that group has said, we have no problem with al-Qaeda. We won't fight al-Qaeda. And not only that, we have given them weapons in the past. So, I think that ship has long sailed. It's not possible.
Bill, lastly on the Iraq front, What is the current status of the Iranian presence there? Ken Timmerman was on the show earlier this week talking about his new book, Dark Forces, and he contends, as you may know, that the Iranians are deeply penetrated. They're not simply supporting the Maliki government. They're deeply penetrated inside all of its ministries at the sort of administrative levels that effectively give them control. Does that sound right to you? And what, in terms of actual boots on the ground, as they say, are we seeing from the Iranians?
I don't see any evidence of that myself. Look, it's no secret that the Iranians attempt to gain influence with the various Shia groups. However, they have to be careful about how they operate. There is two different strains of Shia Islam in that part of the world, and one part of it does not want the Iranian model. So, you know, there certainly is an attempt to vie for influence. There are military advisors for the Iranians within the Iraqi military, but I think it's a bridge too far to say that the actual ministries are under control of the Iranians. They could be, they're influenced. You know, let's face it, where do the Iraqis turn once the U.S. over since 2011, actually even before in 2010, began denying all aid to the and support to the Iraqis? Do they turn to the Saudis? Do they turn to the Jordanians? Of course they're going to turn to the Iranians. They're turning somewhere because the United States has left a void.
Bill, let me turn very quickly to another part of the long war that you've been chronicling so well at the Long War Journal, namely Afghanistan. It seems as though at the moment that President Obama is doubling down on the mistake that he made in Iraq of pulling every American serviceman out, in Afghanistan, we're witnessing a serious upsurge in Taliban activity. How serious is their present offensive, and what does it portend?
What we're seeing today in Iraq is the future of Afghanistan over the next couple of years. The Taliban is beginning to mass in large numbers. A couple of weeks ago, they massed over 1,000 fighters, overran a key district in southern Afghanistan and attacked several other districts. They still control this district in Helmand province, where scores of U.S. Marines and British servicemen died trying to eject the Taliban from there just years ago. They took control of another district in a central province called Ghor. This is one of those provinces where there really hasn't been a major Taliban problem all these years. And over the past 3 days, they launched three major suicide attacks, including a mass suicide assault against Afghan security forces inside of Kandahar, in Kandahar City, the capital. So they're conducting operations because they believe that the U.S. presence is diminishing, because there's less air cover that would stop them from massing in the open. I think they're sending the message to the Afghan people, to the Afghan military: if you fight us, this is what's in store for you. The Taliban are not going away. They have no intentions of conducting peace and talks like people in the administration claim. Remember, they repeated these.
Bill, we have to let it go at that. Thank you so much for your great work at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and the Long War Journal. Keep it up. Come back to us next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.